Hello, and welcome again to Istros Conversations, where today we're moving slightly away from the Balkans to the Czech Republic. And we're talking to Rajendra Chitnis, who is senior lecturer in Czech and Russian at Bristol University. Rajendra is going to tell us about a new book from Yantar Publications by Antonín Bajaja. And I'm not going to say any more about something that I don't know about, so I'm going to pass it straight on to Rajendra to tell you more and to read from his wonderful introduction.
Thank you. So this book is called Burying the Season, and it's kind of hard to define, but it is a series of letters, imaginary letters written by a brother to his sister that remember their childhood and record the memories of people they knew in their childhood about the period before their childhood. And in particular, I think, becomes a kind of record of life in a small Moravian town in the communist period of Czechoslovakia. And that town is Zlín in eastern Moravia, which is famous for the Batia shoe company, for the shoe factory, which was established particularly between the wars and became a kind of model of that form of enterprise, with workers' housing, with schools, and everybody in the town was associated in some way or other with the factory. And of course, this was not popular with the communists, who changed the name of the town from Zlín to Gottwaldov, removed the Batia, or signs of Batia really, from the town, renamed the factory, and continued to make shoes. And so it's really a rather playful, sad, reflective book. I think everything is here, really, which I think communicates in a rather charming way what life was like, I suppose, for ordinary people of different generations in the 20th century, particularly the second half of the 20th century. But I think it's, as I say in the foreword, it's also really a book about remembering and about brothers and sisters, how they talk to one another, how they piece their lives together. So I'll read a bit from this. This foreword was based on an interview, a conversation I had with the author, Antonín Bajaja, I essentially sort of quote him in various places about things he wanted to tell us about the book. The original Czech title of Burying the Season is actually Na krásné modré drevnici, which means on the beautiful blue drevnice. And in fact, in chapter 6, the bourgeoisie of Zlín skate to Strauss's Blue Danube waltz on the frozen Drevnice River, just as the Communist Party is beginning to liquidate them. And we hear about their picnics, grand balls and soirees, their way of life and their values, which are all disappearing. And I suppose it might occur to us that the title at first sight seems sort of to highlight ironically the discrepancy between a sort of city like Vienna with the Danube, you know, one of Europe's great rivers and cities, and a relatively tiny tributary flowing through this industrial town's Zlín. But I don't think Bajaja is making fun of his river or his town. And he says, in fact, I quote him, what the Thames is to London, the Neva is for St. Petersburg, the Hudson for New York, the Nile for Cairo, the Ganges for Benares, and the Danube for Vienna, the Drevnica is for Zlín. And in Burying the Season, he's bringing the river and the town out of the shadows of history. Mm. And he's celebrating it proudly, and he's commemorating with admiration his home, his hometown, and the people he's known and heard of. And he's exploring their place and their experience in Europe's turbulent 20th century.
It's interesting, if I can interrupt you there, because obviously the original title references the river, and I had the same situation when I did the Bosnian book Quiet Flows the Una, which in fact was called Book of Una in the original. And of course we had to change it because Una means nothing to people in England. They might think it's a woman's name, but they certainly wouldn't think it was a river.
Yeah.
So in fact, I suppose Yantar had to change the title because the river's unknown to us.
That's right. Well, it's very interesting. And actually, if you look at the book at the back, in fact, Yantar explained the process where they had a competition where they invited invited friends of Yantar to suggest how else they could title the book. In fact, what they've done is there is a subtitle on the front, Blue Drebnica Waltz. So there is a kind of help to help the reader, I suppose, towards the Czech title. But I think Bayer makes the point that probably most Czechs have no idea where the Drebnica is either. I think the first thing that occurs to the reader of this book, perhaps particularly looking from outside and thinking about Central European literature generally, is that the juxtaposition of the apparently small and marginal with the apparently grand and important is a feature that is often certainly spoken about in relation to Czech literature, and I think indeed to some others of that region. What I think is really the key to this text is that the small is magnified through this emphasis on the personal, private and intimate, precisely at a time when the private and intimate are being invaded and eroded. Mm-hmm. And I have a comment, actually, by Aya made about this. He says, of course, burying the season can only be understood in its entirety with all the local detail by those who grew up in Zlín at the time. I counted on that when I wrote it, and so I was pleasantly surprised when the book found an understanding audience in other towns, even in the countryside. The atmosphere of the period in which the individual episodes take place was full of hypocrisy and fanatical loyalty, no matter where you were. All these sad, cruel, grotesque situations were absurd. It was a synthetic, unified system directed from Moscow, applying not only to Czechoslovakia, but to all the countries of the Warsaw Pact. That's why I think the book might resonate with Poles, former East Germans, Hungarians, Bulgarians, Cubans, North Koreans and Russians. Indeed, Russians understand it very well. And why wouldn't English speakers understand it when they have Orwell and his prescient novels Animal Farm and 1984? I was struck when he said that this felt much more overtly political than the book actually feels. There are lots of references to what the communists are doing, in particular the way in which the sort of jargon of the propaganda invades people's thoughts and influences particularly young people and sort of distorts their approaches to relationships, their families.
In a critical way?
Certainly, in a sort of satirical way. I think it's a sort of tragicomic situation where you have particularly the sister and brother, you know, as sort of children, you know, citing things that they've said at school to their middle class parents. And so I think it has left the reader to how you experience it, whether it makes you laugh. I think that's certainly one intention, but of course then one reflects that the damage that was being done perhaps to sort of more natural relationships and thought processes through this.
So it's typical in that way that they have this, you know, it can have comedy in a lot of these books that I publish as well, but behind there's a kind of sadness.
Absolutely. And that's exactly how this book works.
Right.
But I kind of felt when I was interested because I wouldn't have emphasised the political in the way that, you know, traditionally when we think of perhaps, you know, the most successful 20th century Czech literature, and we think of Milan Kundera and Ivan Klima, where the politics is very central to their books and they exploit, in a sense, the Czechoslovak experience. I don't think this book does it in the same way. And I think that its genius lies in the way it takes the reader beyond the evocation of a particular place, period and experience to this universally accessible context of a brother writing imaginary letters to his sister. And I've written here that, you know, it maps the undulation of mood and sudden shifts of focus that mark the process of remembering. It's quite a strange book to read. It jumps around from period to period. You might argue that it has no real narrative thread. It's got lots of stories.
There's no plot line because it's really letters, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of you're also learning about their relationship, I suppose.
Yes, and it's all about the frame of mind of the brother at the time, and of course it's different periods in his life, you know, when he's quite young and then when he's rather older, when he's more frustrated with life, when he's finding his, you know, his professional life difficult. And
do you feel you know them very well at the end? As a reader?
I think you feel... Yes, I think you certainly know the brother, but I think you experience the sister rather as this kind of imagined interlocutor. I don't know if I don't know if I know her. You know her as the brother perhaps imagines her and wants her to be, I think.
Right, through his eyes.
Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. The novel gently moves the English-speaking reader on from this sort of preoccupation with politicised Cold War writing of disillusioned Czech intellectuals. And I think that the obvious comparison for readers who know literature from this part of the world is probably Bohumil Hrabal, who's actually quoted in the book. It's this kind of disorientating combination of the charming, grotesque and the absurd to characterise the complex and confusing encounter of ordinary people with politics and power. The other thing I think might be interesting, actually, again, for Istros's readers more generally, is that I don't know how much this applies as well to the Balkan region, but Czech literature has been very preoccupied with remembering the communist period.
Yes.
And you have this sort of typically kind of inward-looking negotiation of the recent past. And I would say, generalising hugely, of course, that there's this kind of, first of all, there's this ill-concealed sort of autobiographical basis to these stories. It's really about, you know, in which the person dissociates themselves from, you know, anything bad and makes quite clear that they were always in opposition. There's this sort of ambiguous nostalgia.
There's the weight of the past,
And I think that I don't think that Antonín Baer is this sort of writer, but you almost feel like this is a kind of wiser writer showing a slightly younger generation how you might do it differently.
This is a recent book, isn't it?
Yes, so this is from, I think, 2009.
20 years or more after communism.
Yeah, that's right. And 20 years in which Czech fiction has been dominated by this autobiographical writing.
Right.
Particularly actually focusing on the 70s and 80s rather than the period which is very prominent here, which is the 1950s, which was, you know, certainly a much worse period, I think, for people. You know, there are certain features that it has in common. I think particularly, you know, Czechs tend to idealise the First Republic, the interwar liberal democratic capitalist republic when Czechoslovakia was economically very successful. This is obviously from its independence in 1918 through to the Munich Agreement of 1938. And I don't think it departs really from the sort of nostalgia of that period. And I think that, I mean, I'm drifting away now from my foreword, but I think that what I think is very interesting about this is that this is very unapologetically celebrating the middle class, the bourgeois, and the bourgeois both in terms of the types of things that they do, the types of food they like. There's lots of baking and eating and so on going on. You know, as I say, their picnics, their soirees, their lifestyle. But then what underpins that are these sort of these values, the way in which the parents protect the children from the worst, from what they're experiencing, from the sort of the treatment that they're facing again, among the authorities, and indeed forgiving the children when the children seem to be sort of falling for the propaganda and acting in ways that their teachers and their other people are encouraging them to behave. You know, the parents sort of still are very understanding, and so there's a set of, and I think that perhaps the saddest aspect of this is actually the sense that has all gone now, that it's been lost.
So it's a kind of mourning for a lost time in a way.
Yeah, I think that's what he does. But I think that what he's not doing is trying to create this kind of shared mythology, and this it's not about self-justification. In fact, in certain places he doesn't come out of things very well, I don't think. But there's no cheap sentimentality, there's certainly no anger, and there's no resignation, which I think are the dominant ways in which people have reflected on the communist past. And it's interesting, I asked him about this, and the word that he eventually came up, he thought for quite a long time, was distance, that he felt that precisely this 20 years was actually very valuable to him in actually gaining what we might call perspective, I suppose.
Well, yes, that's very interesting. The two books that I published about the Bosnian War, Seven Terrors and Quiet for the Una, that I mentioned before, both written almost 20 years after the end of it, and you just think, yes, they had enough time to collect themselves, to look back on it. And in fact, both of the authors, you know, use kind of a little bit of magic, a little bit of paranormal, some in a way to describe it. But perhaps they needed that. Perhaps that gave them distance from the subject. And I suppose that's the way the literature of ex-Yugoslavia often differs from Central Europe as well, because they did have this war of the 90s in between, which interrupted any kind of looking back on communism, as it were. You know, the war is there in the way, as it were. How do you look past that?
And absolutely. And it's interesting you say that as well, because something I had that just occurred to me as you were talking is that this is also a Czechoslovak book. Right. You know, Slovakia also features, and I think there's also a nostalgia for Czechoslovakia as a country. And there's a lovely passage, which I think we'll hear at the reading later at Waterstones, where describing how the ex-king of Bulgaria is sort of it goes to live in this Slovak village and has his own locomotive that he gets to drive. And it's kind of the only time when he feels like a king is when he's driving this train. And which is a lovely story, but I mean, hadn't occurred to me till now. And of course, Moravia being the sort of the border territory between, the middle of the old Czechoslovak, you know, had a strong affinity with the Slovaks. And
A wound for them as well, in a different way. Obviously, no violence, but there was involved there. But nevertheless, they were born in one, or they lived in one country, and now it's two.
And certainly for someone of Bayer's age, who spent 50 years of his life in that country. I had a little bit more about this idea of distance, because I thought it was quite an interesting insight into how a writer might work. He said, I intentionally did not write a classic autobiographical book full of historical realia. I tried to see these events through the eyes of a boy who manages to escape from unkind reality into often grotesque dreams. These childhood recollections are interwoven in the novel with my later experiences working in agriculture, and moreover with references to various national and world events from the 1970s to 2009 that offer the reader a context beyond the autobiographical. So we can see all these different devices that take us, don't bring us closer but pull us away and allow us to see things. I think also the fact that we move in time all the time between decades, again, we never dwell, we never get embedded and sort of absorbed in a particular period.
But the English reader would probably feel very familiar here if he's mentioning events that are going on at the time.
Well, I think I remember to when I was talking to Yantar about this book that in fact they liked the fact that you don't need to know a lot. I mean, what you need to know is told to you in the book. And of course, because it's sort of moving around 20th century, what you need to know, you have a kind of rough idea of 20th century history. And you know, and even there, I think things are kind of explained to you. So in that sense, that's another sort of distance that's helped. I mean, I don't think he didn't imagine this book would ever be translated, but in fact, it works rather well.
Excellent. Yeah.
I have said, that I think this layering of perspectives and context creates the distance and space that overcomes the narrow interests and quarrels that the Czechs have about this period, and allows us, a younger reader in the Czech Republic, but also an international reader less familiar with the period, can empathise and can get involved, in all sorts of ways.
How was it? How did the book? Was it? How was it received?
It was extremely successful. Yes. I think I'm trying to now remember how many editions it's gone through, but it's gone through many, and by the standards of the Czech book market of this kind, sort of serious literature, it did very well. He won the state prize, which is the big prize that an author can win in the Czech Republic for this book. I think he's unquestionably one of the best living Czech writers, and he takes a long time with his books, but they're always extremely polished like this one, and really you can see the amount of thought and thinking out that's gone into them, which I think he feels these things gestate over quite a long time as well.
And how about the translation, if I can ask you?
David Short has written here that I think it's one he's translated a large number of works of Czech fiction, and he says this is one of the books he's enjoyed most, and I certainly can see a sort of shared affinity with in terms of interest in nature and butterflies and plants and so on that there is in the books. By profession was cattle breeder. He was a sort of traveled around the farms helping cows to give birth. So and there's a bit of that in the book as well. So there are reflections on sort of collectivization and on the effect on agriculture, which is a much bigger theme for some of his other writing actually. The translation I think is terrific. I think again it's. It'd be interesting to hear from David Short how easily it fell into English.
Yes.
But certainly what we have here is something that reads very nicely and reads very authentically, like the original.
Excellent.
And, the key intertext is also helpful, I think, for international readers, and this is not a Czech intertext. It's Fellini's film Amarcord. Bayer, in fact, says that, you know, he would love it if a DVD of Amarcord was
included in the packet.
It all makes sense. So the novel begins and ends with Manina, which is the first and last lines of Amarcord. So, you know, readers, help, this is the fluff, the balls of poplar fluff that are blowing in the wind, and they of course represent memories. How, and I quote Bayer, he says, you know, memories, how they flutter, float up, swarm, vanish and return, their elusiveness from the first page to the last. So in a way, if you can imagine the poplar fluff flying in the air, or sort of, you know, on a sunny day, that gives you a sense of how this text works.
Very filmic.
You follow one,
yes,
then you follow another.
One,
then you follow an, you know,
and kind of give yourself up to the narrative in a way.
Absolutely, you know, this is definitely, I mean, I think that's is the thing to emphasise, that this is a book that will take time to read in the best sense, that, you know, you want to sit and enjoy it, kind of, you know, and you may well want to read it twice, and you know, it's that sort of book. And I think that is itself a sort of metaphor for the sort of process of remembering takes time. If you're really going to remember someone, if you're really going to do justice to that person, to that time, to your relationship with that person, then you can't do that in a hurry. And so the book is like that.
Like a good wine.
Sort of, yes, everybody would go well with a good wine, but I'm sure that the author would approve of that. It's probably helpful to explain how the text sort of emerged, these letters and what their status was. Bayer told me that from the late 1960s, following the military intervention in Czechoslovakia, he would dispel his sort of gloomy mood, which I think was a sort of national gloomy mood, by writing short texts. And many of these texts actually took the form of stylized letters to his sister Jana, who is called Jeanne, French in the text. He said, you know, incident after incident, you know, I wrote down, but above all, there had to be something funny to lighten the mood. Yeah. I wrote many such letters. Each one was an image or a picturesque sketch. And only many years later did it occur to me that they might be pieced together or unified. And I played with this idea for a while, looking for the right form. And out of the blue, I heard a whisper, Amarcord. image after image, all dynamic and captivating, like those by Fellini, where prose mingles with poetry. The first image is swallowed by the second at once by the third, and each new image retains something of the one before, so that in the end we have a chunky set of images that live both independent from and together with the rest. I think he characterises the book perfectly.
Beautiful. There. I can see an Italian edition is a must.
And of course he points out that Amarcord is about Mussolini's Italy and fascism. So there again is this distancing effect that we can see communist Czechoslovakia through that perspective, which again is familiar to many readers. Yes, and there are lots of other details here that he sort of commented to me. I think that's a key feature of his writing as a whole is this, I mentioned this sort of loss of a kind of middle class bourgeois kind of values, family values, and that kind of thing. But I think the other big thing for him is this sort of encroachment of materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we tend to associate that with kind of capitalism. But in fact, there is almost, you know, communism was also a materialist philosophy,
it's
this kind
yes.
of, you know, this the procreation in thing, you know, the sort of loss of spirituality, perhaps, be another way, the loss of a sense of the spiritual, which to some extent can be organized religion, can be Christianity. To some extent, there's a kind of pantheism about his writing, you know, nature. But it's the ability to sort of see behind things and to see what they represent. And again, that's a lesson that the book, I think, teaches us, which again requires us to read more slowly and to think about, you know, how things map onto other things, how sort of comments echo other comments. It's that sort of sense of the world, which I think he worries that people in the developed world are just losing. He says, you know, people have increasingly lost a sense of perspective on their place in the world, and they've lost a sense of perspective on, you know, space and time that previous generations in the town and countryside still knew. And Bayard, you know, told me how the communist-led persecution of his parents and others lean bourgeois, when it intensified, he and his friends were sort of playing Swallows and Amazons. He remembers that book as you know, a sort of game that they would play out on this river, and not knowing at all what the parents were going through.
Yes.
And then again, he sort of thinks about the farmers and the, you know, the peasants that he worked with when he was breeding cattle, and he says, yeah, these people were no saints, but they had within them what Bergson called élan vital, which I absorbed from them. Thanks to it, they managed to survive the so-called collectivization of agriculture with their heads held high, and moreover with a curious humility, because they were people of faith in the religious and more broadly human sense of the word. Those same qualities of humility and faith also enabled my parents and their friends to get through. And
so
again,
it's something he values very
highly. And yes. I think that that is also something which is, you know, perhaps a feature of age, experience, but
distance.
Again, something that is kind of lost. Yeah, distance,
yes,
exactly.
Yes. No, it's interesting how you've taken, you know, Amarcord, and the writer has taken, and you've mentioned Amarcord and Swallows and Amazons, and all these Western references, which come from, let's say, in inverted commas, our culture.
Yes.
And that's one thing that people often say to me when they read Istvos titles, and I'm sure it's the same with Yanta, is that, you know, these people, these writers, you think they live a long way away, right? But they have all the same references as us.
Yeah.
They know all our story, all our cultural references, and yet we don't know theirs.
Yes.
Because there's been so little literature translated from these countries into English that there hasn't been an exchange.
Yeah.
In actual fact. Yeah. And I think that's very surprising for people. Oh, they were also reading Swallows and Amazons. Oh, they were all, you know, they also grew up watching these cartoons, or, you know, of course it's obvious in one way, but in another way you see that there is no reciprocal relationship in that way, because so little literature gets into English from there.
And I mean, it's interesting when you say it's our literature. I'm sure the same applies to, you know, if we go further south, but Czechoslovakia considers itself part of
us. Well, yes. And, sorry, I didn't.
But it's an important point, because we probably don't. And the Swallows and Amazons example is really interesting, because in a sense, you know, that there's a particular affinity, I think, with England, or with, you know, with Britain, they were very Anglophile in this period, in the interwar period. So Batya, you know, he came to England, he saw the workers' housing in Manchester and in the mill towns, and he, you know, they, when you go there, it's quite funny, Inslee, you know, the houses look like sort of English terraced houses without roofs, so he took elements of what he saw here, and the sort of the morality that he recognised in the kind of factory owner who cared about what his workers were doing in their spare time, and didn't want them to fall into drinking, and to be to be busy and active outside, and to be learning throughout their lives, and all these sorts of things, which are, you know, very important to Zlín and to its identity, and of course were completely sort of rejected in the communist period.
Right, yes.
Although of course they sort of almost adopted exactly the same principles, but from a sort of perspective, they sort of were very different. One understands what a blow Munich was to Czechoslovakia when you understand how close they felt to Britain culturally, and felt that they shared many of the same.
Well, I think the Romanians would give you exactly the same story, they felt definitely betrayed by that.
What's also interesting from what you were saying, though, of course, is, and this is beautifully represented in this book, is that in this period, Czechoslovakia was kind of forced also to absorb the culture of the East, and particularly of Russia.
Right,
and there's an awful lot, there are an awful lot of references to this kind of imposed Russian Soviet culture, you know, nursery rhymes, songs, the propaganda, the Soviet propaganda, the Soviet icons of the communist period. And so it's really, in a way, makes it more fascinating to this sort of adoption of, or this merging of Western and Eastern, or Soviet and Western sort of popular culture,
yes,
and that sort of, you know, creates this person who's telling us this story, who's writing these
letters. Yes,
letters,
a very rich, very wide perspective.
But of course, it sort of makes us reflect on how that person is actually absorbing, are they differentiating, so we manifestly see that the things that have lasted, the things that have depth to him are Fellini, are Ransom, whereas the Soviet is real fluff. Dangerous fluff, but fluff nonetheless,
Lethal fluff, is that?
Yes, that's it. I ended the foreword because I think that this idea of remembering is what's really important. Mm-hmm. It's a way of kind of pulling the text together. You sort of think about the ways one can remember. It's a book that makes you work on that, really. Mm-hmm. And I was suggesting really that, I think a lot of the remembering that goes on in Czech fiction since 1989 is rather selfish and self-indulgent and also self-deluding. It's sort of myth-making. It's, denying the realities in a way which this book doesn't do either.
Interesting.
I don't think that's the main thing. In a sense, this book, as I say, is not intended, I think, to be in any sense antagonistic to other ways of remembering. But what it does instead is to positively express this sort of idea of remembering as part of a spiritually richer, more generous, empathetic and playful and patient humanity. And it's that sort of humanity which possibly belongs to the past, possibly is struggling to survive, and is being sort of almost recorded, therefore, in this text, or perhaps awakened in the reader, and that's what we might hope. The novel sustains a tension between remembering as recovering and remembering as laying to rest. And the title, I think that's why the title's so nice.
Yes, it's a very good title. Did the author did he come up with?
Yes, well, it's a quote from the book.
It's a quote from the book.
So that was, I think, lovely.
Perfect,
and obviously it highlights something in particular that happens in the book. But but Burying the Season is this, I think it relates to a period where I think there's a funeral which is of an important member of the pre-war, the interwar community, dies, and the communists sort of turn the funeral into a travesty. They prevent the people really from mourning and marking the person properly. And I think this is right. And one character says to another, this is the burying of the season. In other words,
it's the end of an era.
Yes, that sort of idea.
A more beautiful way of saying end of an era.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
And I think a lot of these lines must be quotations from people that he remembers people just saying these really.
Because it is autobiographical to a great
absolutely.
Extent.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And that's not hidden, really, I think. But at the same time, because it's presented as fiction, and because so much of it seems to be, a boy making things up and making unpleasant things sound better, and it's not entirely clear which things are made up and which things really happen and whether they happen to those people.
It's
so
slightly unreliable, narrator.
Certainly. And I think unreliability is another aspect of remembering, which
absolutely.
Is
absolutely indeed. In fact, the creation writer Dasha Dundich, who I did, is very interested in this idea of remembering and this fragmentary way that it forms in your mind, and her books reflect that very much.
Right,
it's very, very fragmentary. Yes.
Well, she would like this.
She would. I would buy her a copy.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I just suggested at the end, that Bayer recalls the pain of the past, perhaps in order at last to dispel it, to bury it.
Mm.
And he recalls those long dead to honour their memories and the way he knows how to do that.
So it's cathartic in that way.
I think that, again, as I said, I think we started with this point, that it's quite an ambiguous book in the sense that it can be read as something quite melancholy. These are things that have been irreversibly lost, buried by time and buried by, misguided and bad people. And there's a lot of them in the text. And it also is a kind of reassertion of, the fact that our lives are ephemeral because we live, I think Bayer would suggest, in a very egotistical, materialistic age. Mm. We think we will last forever. We think there's nothing that we can do wrong.
We'll last forever.
And I think he sort of reminds us that we won't. And then we will need people to remember us if we're going to last in any sense at all. But I actually felt, and I reread the book when I wrote the before I wrote the foreword, and I actually thought in the end it's not actually that it's not sad in a despairing sense. It's charming, you know, and sad in that way. But it's actually about hope. It's about the fact that, you know, we can reconnect when we want to, if we want to. We can almost disinter these things, you know, the good things. You know, we can bring them back.
Yes, because things come and go, like communism.
Yeah, they come and go. But we can bring these things up. We can, you know, we have writers to do that for us, but we can also do it.
Yes.
So in that sense, it's quite an inspiring sort of
book. You've sold it to me as a very, very inspiring and touching book. So it sounds delightful.
Great. So I think, you know, if people are looking for something sort of long to read through the winter, you know, that they can sit in a chair and just get into, I think this is something to think about.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Brenda. Thank you.
Awesome.